Good evening, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. This is the first of the Right Side podcasts on the new Gripped platform. That's right, we've moved over to Gripped. It's a, I'd say an alternative news platform. We'll be doing more work with them as we kind of move forward, but if you guys want to check out the site, you can go to www.gripped, that's gript.ie. And you'll be able to see all the podcasts we're doing, podcasts by other people, and also all of the news and opinion from actually quite a variety of sources. Don't worry though, nothing here will be changing, and if they're changing, it'll be for the better anyway. So, after that short sort of housekeeping notice, today we wanted to talk about Simon Harris. In light of a very particular article, which was published on Politico, which is titled The Next Irish PM? And that article basically runs true. It's a puff piece on Simon Harris about pretty much how great Simon Harris is and why nothing that's gone wrong is really Simon Harris's fault, I think would be a fair way of putting it. Now, before we talk about this article, Michael,
yes.
I did want to mention one thing you may not have noticed.
What's that?
We've talked previously about how Simon Harris's involvement during the abortion referendum gave him a great deal of social cachet, with certain reporters who seem to be going out of their way to make him look good because he managed to build up so much of a personal relationship with them.
Oh, absolutely. He is, as they would say in the Arabian Nights, he is best beloved.
He is, and he is, because of that, and it was a very wily political move on his part and not one without risk, so, you know, kudos for his decision on that, I suppose, from his political standpoint. I did, when I read this article, I did kind of go and look at the reporter who wrote it, who's a woman called Naomi O'Leary. This is the great thing about social media, Michael. It's like you can reach out and touch journalists, see into their mind. Now, Naomi does not talk about Simon Harris a lot on her social media, but would you like to guess, if you go into her social media, what her banner image is?
Well, I'm going to guess on the basis that, from the context, something to do with Together for Yes or Repeal or anywhere you like. Am I in the ballpark?
It is a mural of Savita Halappanavar with Yes written over her face and people dropping flowers off in front of it.
Well.
So I think that may explain, not to impugn Naomi's motives, but I think that may explain a lot of why this is so positive about Simon Harris. So I just wanted to point that out before we actually run through
it. I'm sure her motives and her intentions are absolutely good, and she writes in good faith, but she sees him with the eyes of love. And of course, when we see him with the eyes of love, it's difficult.
We're going to run through this article, and at the same time, we're going to run through some stats on the Irish healthcare system.
Oh, we have some good ones.
We have some really fun ones on a wide range of issues that are not outside Simon Harris's purview, and so he cannot claim, as this does about the cervical check scandal repeatedly, that he wasn't there when it happened. And there's a sort of it's not really his fault though, is it?
Yeah, I was in the toilet.
I just wasn't there. So it opens by doing the whole the health service is terrible, bad for your career, and Harris has seen his share of scandals. So he survived a no confidence vote, the cervical check screening failure that the article says resulted in deaths, but does say it was before he got there. And then it says this line: together, these challenges provide good training for a future prime minister, a job that Harris doesn't rule out wanting to take on. And here is the quote, I think, pulls this all together, from Harris himself.
Yeah.
Certainly, if you manage the Department of Health, I suppose it shows your ability to take on a big role in government.
I think,
which is sort of like the captain of the Titanic,
yeah,
saying that his experience in ship control or ship navigation shows he's ready to take on greater responsibilities. It's perfectly true as long as you don't think about what the ship was doing when he was there.
Yeah, it's. I think Simon is absolutely correct. If you manage the Department of Health, it shows your abilities. The problem is Simon hasn't managed the Department of Health.
The Department of Health, the HSE, had to come out recently, I think last week, and say it didn't know how many consultants it employed.
Gary, I just want to very quickly just roll back a sentence or two. You mentioned the fact that in the article, it says he survived a no confidence vote. Now, but the article actually says, after the disclosure, which sounds like it was something that suddenly appeared, that we hadn't, that wasn't in public sight for quite some time, but rather the disclosure of the significant cost overruns at a children's hospital. See, that's the problem is, it isn't a children's hospital. Not yet. It should have been. It should have been 2 years ago. It should have been 4 years. But it isn't even a yet children's hospital. It is yet a hole in the ground. And he has still got cost overruns running into 2.4 billion.
Whoa, Michael. Simon Harris came out in February of this year and said that he will personally see that no money is wasted in the delivery of the National Children's Hospital and that the overspend is not a scandal. Are you saying that's wrong in some way?
I'm saying myself and Simon probably use the English language in a very, very different way. And I suspect that Simon is
He said
more
the
successful.
Only scandal in relation to this project would have been the decision to cancel it.
Yeah, which is lovely. I don't know what that means. I suspect that if you examined it, it might fall into the category of not true.
If you take a project that was originally costed at 650 million,
yeah,
and then it's gone to at least, I mean, the official estimates are 1.7 billion. Everyone I've talked to has said at least 2.1. I don't know. I think if you increase a project's cost by 300% on your tenure and you don't seem to notice when it's happening,
but
I'd say that would be a scandal in most countries. In fact, I believe the government of Finland just fell over its inability to fix its health service.
It did indeed. I think I would regard as a scandal the ministers, and I'd say in fact this government, but in this case this minister, absolute refusal to listen or to engage with the parents of six children, who again and again and again pointed out, along with dozens and dozens of experts in the field, both of hospital building and sick children, that putting it in the middle of James's was the stupidest place. But that's right. Simon stuck to his guns, as this government does. And even in the face of public opinion and facts and massive
sense.
And common sense and massive
and
overruns,
fiscal prudence,
they said, no, we're strong. Therefore, we don't change our minds. And we have what we have. And we don't actually even know what we have yet. We know we have several holes in the ground at James's. And Leo has promised, what was it, that it'll be open by 2023?
I believe the original quote was, bar a meteorite strike.
Yeah, bar a meteorite. So, folks, Keep your eye out. Keep your eye out.
Wasn't it originally 2021?
It was originally 2020. It was before.
So the meteor strike was about the original opening time.
Oh, no, that's not the original. When did we start? When did we break ground on this?
God knows.
To be honest, I remember I
gave an interview on radio about, I'd say 2 years ago, about this project. And I remember them asking me questions about how it started. And I had to legitimately go, that was so long ago, I've actually forgotten the specifics of it, nor do I think they would matter if I could remember them.
It is my sense, and I am very possibly, and maybe even rightly wrong with this, that at the very, very beginning of this whole process, that it should be open by, it should already be open, if we were to go by the very earliest.
I did like that time when it got scuttled by our planning permission laws.
Yes.
Because that was just a wonderful confluence of areas of ineptitude.
All coming together in a beautiful symbolic statement about the inability of this government to know what the fuck one left hand is doing to the right hand.
So on things that can be Simon Harris's fault, I'm going to give you guys a website that you can go to and you can see the stats, so you don't need to trust us. And that website is the National Treatment Purchase Fund. Its website is www.ntpf.ie. And if you go on there, it will give you the figures for waiting lists. National waiting lists by hospital, by speciality, general trends for the previous weeks. And you can go and see what the waiting lists are like. Now, we won't go into the figures there now particularly, but I do want to give you a headline that I found when I was looking for stats on this. And it's a headline that says, waiting times in Irish hospitals are currently the worst in Europe. And I saw that and I went, God, that's terrible. And then I went, when is this from? And it's from 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The European Health Consumer Index of 2015 had said we were the worst in Europe. And then I checked out this year's one, or well, the last one that's released. We are still the worst. In fact, we basically go off the chart, literally.
Yeah, you literally can't see it's where it goes next.
But here's what I really want to give you about this, just to give you an idea of how bad the waiting lists have become and how bad the official Irish response has been. So this is from the Eurohealth Consumer Index, which is a report into all European health services and how they rank up on a variety of metrics. So it said, in 2018, Ireland is alone in last position for accessibility, with patient organisations steadily giving very pessimistic feedback in the survey. Unfortunately, this was confirmed by the Irish HSE and Ministry of Health after the release of the EHCI 2015 report, when they said in a memo that the programme initiated to reduce healthcare waiting times aims at a target of no more than 18 months for a specialist appointment. Even if that target is reached, Ireland will have the worst waiting times in Europe. Which is to say, the high bar that Simon Harris has for waiting times is to merely be the worst in Europe, but physically able to put on the chart. I also do like the fact, because this is an actual, a fairly formal report, and after it has the quote about the 18 months, it just has, close quote, open brackets, exclamation point, close brackets. Which is not a thing that normally happens.
No.
But here's the other thing that's great about this. They point out that patient survey responses are still much more negative than the official waiting time data. And for this reason, after several years of accepting official Irish waiting time statistics, the EHCI has since 2015 scored Ireland on patients' versions of waiting times. Now, that kind of sounds like a very careful way of saying we think the Department of Health is lying to us about waiting times.
Now, it's funny you should say that, Gary, because if you know the CIA collates all this information about every country in the world.
Oh, the World Factbook.
World Factbook.
Actually, it's really useful, yeah.
Well, they had a look at it. It's an opportunity on that to show in a few more stats. Because when they looked, they have two sets of ranking figures for health systems of the world. And in one of them, which goes from 1 to 46 countries, maybe it's I think it's connected to the OECD figures. One of the stats that's considered is accuracy and completeness in filling out reports. And Ireland scored 45th out of 46 on that. So that would give me, that's maybe an insight into that, the whole issue of reports. I would point out that in that particular list, Ireland comes last in its healthcare index. Now, it doesn't come last in the other one, to be fair. Out of 86 countries surveyed, we come 83rd, jolly well beating the lard out of the Republic of Macedonia, Iraq, and Mongolia.
But really, because we lose to Macedonia on accessibility.
Now, these are older figures, so Macedonia may have got better. These figures, some of these figures are 3-4 years old. It's unfortunate to see that at the time of this survey, we were doing worse than Venezuela.
I love the idea that in the time that Simon Harris has been in power, the Irish system has gotten worse, or at least gotten better slower than Macedonia.
Well, I think we'd all like to see Macedonia doing well. So I don't know if that. But one thing we should say, because this is something that, well, there's the politicals of all brands and people inside the service will talk about, is, well, you know, the fact is the Irish people expect a certain kind of health service, a certain sophistication of health service, but they're not willing to pay for it. The money isn't there. We're not willing to put up taxes. And this is the constant conundrum facing any government in the Western world, where everybody's demanding more all the time. But when it actually comes to the point of saying putting up taxes, they will say, no, sorry, we're not accepting that. The fact is, after the last great crash, personal taxation in Ireland went through the roof, certainly for the people in the middle and the top end anyway, and all sorts of other taxes and duties and components. So the actual income intake into the government was massive, but that wasn't to service necessarily the health service. And we have been told that health spending in Ireland is low. And one of the reasons is that, for example, if you look at health spending as a percentage of GDP, Ireland will come somewhere between 24th and 27th position in the OECD figures. But that's not what you should be looking at, because the GDP figures for Ireland are simply wrong in the sense that they don't reflect the economy. If you look, for example, the same is true of Luxembourg. Luxembourg, because it's the home of a lot of international banks, there's a lot of GDP that's on the books, but that GDP isn't actually realistically part of the economy that people live in. That's GDP which gets exported. What you have to look at are PPP, international dollars, which is price parity position. So this gives you an understanding of the real spending. And there are different figures. There's OECD figures and the World Health Organization figures. But if you look at, in one list, we come sixth in the world in health spending per capita. We spend 5,500, now these are figures going back a couple of years, going back to 2016. We were spending 5,528 euro per capita, which is almost the same as Germany. Ahead of us, you have Norway, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and the United States. But we're spending more than Sweden, more than Netherlands, more than Austria, more than Denmark, more than Belgium, Canada, Australia. It's countries that have patently, Italy, and God, the Italians are spending 3,391 per capita on this. And I can tell you, the French, 4,600, with health services at the acute level, certainly, which are significantly better than ours. I mean, really significantly. And high quality care, I mean, you're not talking about substandard surgeries. You're also talking whether this is important to you or not. If you go to a hospital in Italy, you'll be dealt with by an Italian physician and an Italian surgeon who will speak fluent Italian. And I think that's quite reassuring for people that they're dealing with people that they don't have worries about communication problems, which is not always the case in Ireland. We drop one place if you look rather than the OECD figures or the WHO figures, we drop to seventh. But we are spending a lot of money, ultimately. It's not a question of resources. The resources are there, and there are wild overruns, even with the resources allocated.
No, we have just dumped money into the health service with absolutely no control or understanding of where it's going. And when you look at, well, what does that actually mean in real terms for people? Well, according to the National Treatment Payment Fund, there are now roughly about 16% of the country is on a hospital waiting list. It's roughly 765,000 patients.
Yeah.
Are on hospital waiting lists, of which about outpatient lists are at about 565. And it's going up.
It's not just going up, but if you look at the figures, say, between, which we saw, there was an article we saw with, compare the figures under Cowan, Micheál Martin, then Varadkar. Now, the figures are going, they're not only going, they're going up quickly. This is a fairly steep line. Going from a bad position, it was already a bad position, to a worse position, that's really concerning. There is no sense that anybody has got this under control at all.
So let's go through a couple of other things. Do you remember there was an issue about 2 years ago where children with scoliosis were found to be waiting for years?
Yes.
In some cases, for treatment. And there was an investigation of this, I think RTE did it, and there's some wonderful videos of Simon Harris on national radio saying that this would never happen again, and that this would be fixed, and that it's not going to take another investigation to fix this.
Yes.
If you can remember that, I recommend you put in scoliosis Simon Harris into Google, go news, and do it by newest. And you might be shocked to find that, currently there's a great deal of scoliosis patients waiting more than 18 months for access. I know this is primarily, by the way, children, because for those who don't know, scoliosis is where the spine kind of contorts or bends, and it's a degenerative condition. So the longer you wait, it can get much, much worse.
But this is indicative of a wider problem. I don't know if this is because if the parents have votes that children don't, and maybe the children are being left on the side here. But if you look at the waiting lists currently for psychiatric intervention, for pediatric child or adolescent psychiatry. If you're working in a school, and I've got many friends who are teachers, and teachers are very often the first people that are going to be in a position to identify if a child has a behavioural issue or maybe a learning difficulty or whatever. But the one thing you want is you want to have a quick assessment so you can put in place a plan to deal with this, so you can have early intervention. When you're talking about these kinds of problems, early intervention makes a massive difference, as it does also with physical and organic problems like scoliosis. You're looking at, I was talking to a teacher recently who said that in her area, it was 3 years to get the first assessment. That's not a treatment plan, and that's not even it's an assessment. They have to wait 3 years. I mean, if you're talking about a child at the age of six, by the time they're nine, I mean, if you're talking about behavioural or educational difficulties, that child is so far behind and so disadvantaged at that stage that whatever you're going to do is going to be far more difficult to achieve, far more intensive and far more costly if you're actually going to put a proper treatment process in place.
Since Fine Gael came to power, since Simon Harris has been in power, do you know... Here's one you may not actually know, Michael.
Yeah.
The number of patients who've been waiting at least a year and a half to see a specialist. Would you like to guess how much that's gone up, percentage-wise?
Oh!
Or, you know, maybe fallen. Yeah.
I don't think it's fallen. I'd say...
No, I think that's safe.
I think so. Since when Fine Gael got into power, or since Simon came in?
Fine Gael, let's go with. To be fair to Simon.
Yeah, to be fair to Simon. Well, I know it's gone. The total figures went from 300,000 over to 500,000. So let's call it 20%.
You know what? Let's not be fair to Simon. Let's just do it when Simon is there. And I'll just tell you the figure.
Okay.
Since 2016, and Simon came in, I think, in the middle of 2016.
Yes.
So pretty much dead on to when they start. It's gone up 1,100%.
What? Could we rewind, please? Sorry. Rewind. I said the number of people waiting for over 18 months has gone on 1,100%. No, I think maybe you've misread that, Gary, or somebody's. That's not possible.
No, that is the headline I'm looking at.
There's not that many sick people in the country, surely.
Well, I mean, Michael, you may need to take that up with The Independent. Because according to The Independent, there's been an increase of 1,110%.
Sweet Jehoshaphat.
Since 2016. So since Simon Harris has come on board.
Yes.
It's gone up 1,100%.
Sorry, can I just say something again on the content, just after that? Certainly, if you manage the Department of Health, I suppose it shows your abilities to take on a big role in government. I think it's important to keep saying that.
Well, think of it this way, Michael. If he's saying that the more people under your purview that you're managing, the more you're proving yourself,
mm-hmm.
I mean, increasing the amount of the public that your department is dealing with by 1,100%, really increases the amount of people that you can say that you help.
This is just...
I mean, it's not true, but you can say it.
But waiting lists like this, in a system funded like ours is... Do you remember that really interesting interview you did with the man who built the BlackRock clinic?
Oh, Jimmy Sheehan.
Dr. Jimmy Sheehan. And you remember he said that the reason that ultimately he got into the business of opening private hospitals was because he was an orthopaedic surgeon. He's an orthopaedic surgeon. And he was working, I imagine, because of that in Kappa at the time. And he was just he felt completely underutilized, that he wasn't doing the amount of work that he should have been doing because of constraints of various natures within the system.
Yeah, they had budgeted for his wages, but hadn't budgeted for the additional costs.
Yeah, the operation.
Of the surgeries.
Yeah, the theatre.
Just had him do nothing.
See, the operation. And he said, he's he's a skilled surgeon in an area where you've got people, let's say, with chronic problems with hips or knees or whatever, that he felt that he could change people's lives. I mean, that's why very often doctors get into medicine, particularly. He was in a position to really, really improve people's quality of life. But he wasn't given the chance. He said the reason he opened wasn't for making money, was to do that. And now, what we're talking about here is people living in misery. More and more people living in chronic pain, who need knees done or hips done, or they have sight issues. I mean, we have the blind bus now going up every week to Belfast. I mean, that's genuinely embarrassing. Is that not embarrassing?
Let's take the scoliosis case. For scoliosis, it's a degenerative disorder. The spine will continue to kind of twist. It kind of bends people over. It puts additional pressure on their organs. It is unpleasant to see. I imagine it's deeply unpleasant to live with.
Yes.
And it's just continuing to get worse. But here's I think, let's focus on what Simon Harris has done for the children of this country. In 2016, there were 271 children waiting on the... waiting more than 18 months to see someone. It's now 12,100. So I'm all Ireland, we have a tendency to be okay with mediocre ministers. Simon Harris is not a mediocre minister. He is one of the worst ministers for health this country has ever had. And his tenure is going to be marked by pain, suffering, and the broken bodies, particularly of children, which is why I found his involvement in the abortion referendum quite funny on some level, because I have an interest in health department statistics. So regardless of what your views on abortion are, Simon Harris standing up and telling people he gave a damn about women's healthcare was something I just found deeply personally amusing, because if he cares, maybe he should have improved any of the things about the health service that would have helped women, but he didn't.
Ironically,
he has made it worse.
Ironically, he was deeply at the very, very best disingenuous when talking about one area of the health service that was actually excellent, which was maternal care, and one area of the health system which has historically been up there with the very best in the world, which is the care for women during pregnancy and the mortality rates in that period, where Ireland scores terribly, terribly high. And yet, on that one area, he was willing to go around in scaremongering and essentially defaming the system in the most horrific way. But the rest of the system was perfectly wonderful. I suppose I was going to say, to be fair, there are endemic problems here. But one of the things, if I was going to say one thing about Harris more than any other that is indicative of his failure and of his ineptitude and his fundamental lack of ability or talent. You take Mary Harney as an example. You ask people who are the best or the worst health ministers in the last 30 years, 40 years. Harney will very often be suggested as one of the best. She will occasionally, by ideologues of which people disagree with me, as being one of the worst. But all ministers who really engage with their department, one of the things they tried to do was reform the department, to make a genuine attempt in some way to create structural changes within the department. He's there 3 years, which is longer, as he points out himself, than most ministers have. Are you aware of him having done anything?
Well, here's the thing. When we talk about reform, his big thing has been Sláintecare.
Yeah.
The problem with Sláintecare, for those who aren't aware, Sláintecare is this, it was agreed on by all of the parties. It is largely nonsensical.
It's nonsense, Gary. It's never, ever going to happen.
It's not even properly costed.
Not
it is
at all.
Purely so that people can say, well, look, here's a plan that has something for everything that we signed off on, and the government didn't implement it. Because it's totally unimplementable.
Yes.
And that, generally with a government proposal, if it's not properly costed, you know that no one really treats it seriously, because if you're going to make a massive change, you generally want to know if you can afford it. So if you don't bother to do that, you probably don't care that much. Because that's a lot of work, and it doesn't need to be done, because the plan doesn't matter. That has been the thing he's clung to say that, And he lists it in the article, the Politico article, as one of his major accomplishments, that he agreed on this healthcare reform plan. Nothing has happened with it, because nothing can happen with
nothing
it.
Would happen.
The only thing that's come out of it that actually looks like it might be implemented is breaking up the HSE and going back to the regional health boards.
Well, you know, maybe, because you and I have both talked to people, you certainly more than I, who were actually involved in the creation of the HSE. But it consistently, you know, if you talk to people within the system who are working, trying to make a system work, what I'm hearing is, again and again, the system is beyond repair.
I think, on one hand, I think the thing just needs to be burned down, frankly. But on the other, the health boards also had major problems with them.
Oh, I'm not saying replace them with the health boards. I'm simply saying that the idea of getting rid of the HSE is not a bad one. The health boards had problems. I don't think it is incredibly retrograde at a level, planning level, but also of imagination, to say, well, the only other option we have. There are so many, just looking at Europe, there are so many different types of options available for the delivery of a health service, and almost all of them deliver it. Better results for less money. The French system, you know, okay, the Swiss system is more expensive. It's probably the best in the world. The Dutch system is around the cost the same of ours and is probably going bankrupt. But there are systems out there that work better than ours and cost less. It surely should not be beyond the ken of mankind to generate something similar.
But no, it's one of those reasons. I find it quite funny when people in Ireland sort of go, are you right-wingers, you want to privatise the health service? Because you sort of go, I mean, I don't really have any strong feelings on the privatisation of the health service. It wouldn't bother me if it happened, and it wouldn't bother me if it didn't. But you sort of look at the existing service and go, well, we can hardly make it worse, can we?
This talk, we are affected, no doubt, by the language of that we hear on our larger neighbour, because we read their newspapers and we listen to their radio and their television. And one of the worst things you can say to anybody politically in the kingdom, even Margaret Thatcher, when she was accused, and I use the word accused, of wanting to privatise the National Health Service, she absolutely denied it and ploughed more money into it. They actually have a pretty mediocre health service, for which they pay a lot of money. But I don't care how it's funded, in a sense. As if it works, you get value for it. But we don't. And it's getting worse. And, you know, one of the areas historically that we actually did well on was primary care. We had, in comparison to most other countries, we had a good GP system. It was, people could go to whatever GP they wanted. They could choose their own GP. They had a relationship. They could change them at will. But also, it was very easy for people to get to see a GP. You could, I friends from Canada certainly astounded by the notion that you could wake up feeling ill on a Monday and stroll down to your clinic and get seen by a doctor on the Monday afternoon. When you have situations in Canada where you're talking about like 3, 4, 5 weeks or indeed months for an appointment. Even the GP now, the GP service is under attack. Increase the numbers of towns, small towns and villages that simply don't have a doctor or don't have a GP available to them are getting bigger and bigger. The number of people going to general practice is getting smaller and smaller. And the other safety valve we had were foreign doctors. And I don't know if you've seen the figures recently. It's increasing when they're being interviewed and surveyed on it. Foreign doctors are now saying they don't want to stay here. Some of them don't want to come and some of them don't want to stay. But we've also set up a system which punishes foreign doctors outside the EU who come here and want to actually advance. They want to do postgraduate degrees. They want to do extra specialisation. And the brightest, the most ambitious, the best of doctors that we get, we say no. You're not in the EU, so we won't allow you actually take part in the university courses that you want to improve yourselves. So the best doctors after 2 years leave. They get a couple of quid and they go. And the doctors that are left behind are the ones that have poorest language skills, which it does affect clinical capacity, and the least ambition and the least desire to improve their skill base. But they're the ones that we actually incentivize to stay.
On the GP system, under attack is perhaps putting it a little lightly. The GP system seems to be on the verge of collapse.
Yes.
There appear to be areas of the country where you may have an entire county that has one GP active at a time, particularly for out-of-hours service. I think it's basically impossible to get, outside of Dublin and maybe a couple of other areas, to get a new GP if you don't already have one.
I'm very lucky. I hadn't realized this until talking to people outside of Norway, that we have we're tremendously lucky with our GPs here, because there are two very large practices with traditions of providing a very extensive service. But I was talking to my GP there 6-7 weeks ago about this, and he said, no. He lectures in, he goes to the universities, he lectures in general practice. And he said the classes are getting smaller. They're also and this is having an effect. And I'm not saying this negatively, but in one case, I was talking to a doctor. He said he was teaching a class. There were 120 student GPs there, of whom 105 were women. Well, we know from the experience of the last 15, 20 years that women in general practice will not put up with the kind of nonsense that men historically have done, or men historically have been more interested in working much longer hours to make more money and to have a bigger practice and do it. They seek different things from their professional lives, shall we say. Put it that. But if we see the disappearance of those, shall we, rather fixated, ambitious, money hungry young men from general practice, we're going to see the availability of hours continue to decline.
I mean, we also see it in the in relation to consultants. There are consultant posts which we have not been able to fill in, I'd say, 2 years at this point. And consultants, from an Irish standpoint, are quite well paid. The problem is that while from an Irish standpoint you're quite well paid, the tax rate is very high.
Yes.
The general standard of the job is quite low by international standards. And anyone who's good enough can simply go to America or somewhere like that, and earn...
If you were to say a coronary consultant, or any anaesthetist or whatever, and you're in Dublin, when you consider, number one, when you consider what you're going to be paying in personal taxation and the costs of living and the cost of housing, and then you look at what you can walk into any hospital in the United States, Northeast, and the salary you can pick up and take home, compared with, again, with housing costs. You know, it's a bit of an... We're looking at a situation right now, I mean, leaving consultants out of it, there are well over 1,000 doctors, Irish doctors, young Irish doctors in Australia. I think the figures are similar for Canada. And there's no sign that that's stopping.
No, but here's the thing, Michael. In America, I don't know if you know this, there are 7 states that have no personal income tax.
Yeah.
And there's 2 that don't tax wages at all.
Yeah, they rely completely on sales taxes.
Yeah, it's just the only things they'll tax are interest, and I think certain investment incomes.
So, obviously...
Do you want to stay in a country where you'll pay a marginal rate of 49% to 52%, or do you want to move somewhere where you don't pay anything on that?
And one of the problems there is not just the government, but it's the government because of lack of spine. There is a widespread sense, when you talk about this in Ireland, it's simply, I have to say, it's just begrudgery. People say, they were being paid 150,000 a year. You should be happy with 150,000. Isn't that fabulous? Yeah, lads, but if he can get 300,000 a year somewhere else, that's the market.
There is this little bit of... There is a little bit of begrudgery that people would seek to kind of get as much money as they can. But I generally find if you talk to people like, oh, so would you leave money on the table if someone went, you could move and earn twice as much, and with a lower rate of tax, you may actually have 3 times as much money? I don't think many people would go, you know what, I'm happy where I am. I'm not even going to consider moving.
No, but there is this thing with doctors. For some reason, they're just greedy. We have to recognise that the market exists, that these people have a value. Now, it may not be the case that we're going to offer the same prices, the same salaries that you would get in a hospital in New York or Boston or Chicago. But then again, you don't have to. All you have to do is come close enough, because most of these doctors do want to stay in Ireland. If you talk to them, they say they'd much prefer to practice here if they could. They also would like to see higher standards of practice. That's another issue. But there'd be no serious attempt. Harris has made no serious attempt to do anything about that. And that's a running sore.
Although, if you'd like to know why 7 states, or sorry, I believe 9 states, have no income tax, It's because, according to the American Legislative Exchange Council, those states consistently outperformed the national average on GDP growth, employment growth, and in-state migration, which I don't think is terribly surprising.
Well, no, you might be surprised, but I think a lot of people, a lot of our friends to the left would be both surprised and horrified.
It's like if you aren't taxing that money, you'll probably spend it on something or maybe start a business. We can't be having that.
Yeah, but you could spend it on the wrong things, probably.
On back to this article, we'll just run through. Simon, he points out he's now one of the longest-serving health ministers in the EU and says that's kind of interesting in a minority government. Does raise the question of, should he be?
It raises the terrible Rubik's Cube of a puzzle.
It's a sort of, in other countries, I would have been fired by now, but yes. I haven't been.
Just passing by the way, we are told that he has introduced one of the toughest laws on alcohol in Europe.
Is he talking about the booze burqa?
I have no idea, because I can't think of anything that has actually come into law. I've heard people talk about lots of stuff, which I deeply disapprove of, particularly minimum alcohol pricing, as you know. But none of this is law. None of this has come in. The booze burqa, that's the thing in the separation in the shop.
Mm.
That hasn't happened yet. May not happen because of the costs that is going to be imposed on small retailers. There's doubt about it now, or if it will, how it will be. It won't have to be a permanent barrier, but so far there's nothing that has actually been done, which I think is maybe indicative of this article. We're having to throw in things to pad it out at the level of actual achievement.
What about this, Michael? Because you know a little bit about Simon Harris's background.
Yeah.
He says, I got involved in politics through an activist background and through my advocacy work, and I do generally believe that politics and political office are a way of bringing about social change. Now, my only input in that is from talking to people in Fine Gael, they don't believe Simon Harris believes in anything but Simon Harris. I mean, to an extent, even they find disconcerting.
I remember talking to somebody once at a meeting where Simon was present as a young man, and he said he was slightly frightened of him because he had never come across so much concentrated ambition in such a small package before in his life. Now, he had a remarkable go. He started off life as a very young man. He went off on the council and got a tremendous result, a bunch like Leo, the Leo story, when Leo got the nod for the council seat in the Northern England and picked up, I don't know how many quotas, and Simon did something. So, the activist, frankly, that escapes me. That bit where, what the activism was. I do remember, of course, he was quite strong on the whole pro-life thing. I remember him advocating, I think people, pro-lifers should vote for him because he was more pro-life than Billy Timmons. Would that be what he's talking about?
He didn't just advocate, he sent a letter to the pro-life groups.
Oh, he did, yes.
Asking them to vote on him because he was so strongly pro-life.
It was a red line issue for him. Red line, absolutely. So maybe that would have been the area I would have most associated him as an activist or advocate. It was the pro-life issue. So I don't know. Does he still? That may have evolved, Gary. I think his position there.
There are some really kind of tone deaf lines in this article. Here's one where he's talking about cervical check and the outcry, and it says Harris remains upbeat about it, saying that the scandal has helped improve the screening program.
Well, then it was all worth it.
That to me just sounds like something you don't want to say about that. Like, sure, we killed a couple of people.
Yeah.
But, like, we got better.
Yeah, we got better. Sure, it's all probably worth it.
And you know what?
In the end.
Dead people can't complain about the standard of their healthcare.
This is very true. This is very true. What normal politician, it is perfectly normal for any politician to want to get the biggest job, whether it's Prime Minister or Taoiseach or Chancellor or President, whatever you are. It is absolutely normal that you should. In fact, I would say if you shouldn't be in politics unless some part of you wants that job, because you want the job that can help, that will put you in the position to do most of the things that you want to do to make the place that you live in a better place. But he says, he comments about his own professional future. He explained, just means I wouldn't rule out the possibility of becoming Prime Minister. Nobody, no normal politician would ever come close to say something.
That's a real... You hear politicians saying that exact line only at very specific times. And it's a standard line for those times.
That's when the present Prime Minister has just resigned in a chicken and money scandal. And somebody's catches you coming out of Dáil Éireann or coming out of Leicester House and say, well, I wouldn't rule it out, but, you know, I have no intentions at the moment. I want to spend more time with my family or whatever. But not now. Not in the back. It just seems, again, oddly tone deaf.
There's also the point where he notes that he has his ministry has a profound impact on people's lives, massive budget, massive amounts of people, and then says, I'm actually really enjoying my job.
Yeah.
Which, if you were improving the health service, that's just the sort of line people don't like.
Yeah. Also, and I say this just looking at the man, he doesn't look like a man who's enjoying his job. You know those famous photographs of presidents before they became president and 8 years later? You know, that Lincoln, the most famous one, he looked like he'd aged 20 years. I think if you had a picture of Simon before and after, I think Simon's finding the whole experience a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, Simon looks like he is actually draining him of life.
It does, physically. It really does. It just does.
Although Trump has ruined the thing of presidents appearing older, he actually seems to be getting younger.
He's glowing. He's absolutely glowing. He's like this huge orange cat. It's licking up all of the hatred, and it just makes him stronger.
On Simon Harris and the idea of Simon Harris being Taoiseach, or PM, as Politico calls it, Simon Harris is not liked inside Fine Gael.
No.
The ideologues in Fine Gael, the actual people with an ideological centre, think he believes in nothing.
Yes.
The idea, they see him as effectively Fianna Fáil. The way they see Fianna Fáil as we just say things that people want. That the old core of Fine Gael views themselves as actually believing in things and being contrary to Fianna Fáil's just give the people what they want, amongst many other things. Yes. They see Harris as basically Fianna Fáil with a little bit of a Fine Gael glaze.
Well, I think he may come from actually Fianna Fáil originally.
He does.
I think he was in Ogra for a little bit before he crossed the divide.
They don't see him as one of them. They don't like him. They don't think he's good at his job. He is pretty useless at actual implementation of anything.
Yeah.
I mean, terrible. Everything he's tried to do has failed spectacularly or simply not happened. The only thing he's actually good at is Twitter.
Yeah. And his problem is, right now, if you're going to put a bet down, and listen, politics is a funny game. Right now, if you're going to put a bet down, I think most people would say that it is the likelihood is that Leo Varadkar will not be Taoiseach after the next general election. Now, it's not a far, far done from a done deal, but right now, Leo is not looking good for it. Now, if that was to be the case, and particularly if it was a bad result, and particularly if the fact that the expectation was widely that whoever was leader of Fine Gael would stay in for another one because Fianna Fáil were still too toxic. There's a chance that Varadkar is gone and Coveney is in. No, Coveney, I don't think there's any reason to believe that Coveney is interested in advancing in any way, shape or form Simon Harris's career.
No, I mean, Harris did come behind him for the leadership contest. But even if you like Simon Harris, if you just sit down and you look at how the health department and how the HSE and National Health has gone under him, there are a few spots, like the abortion referendum, where even if you don't support it, you go, politically astute move.
Yeah.
That built support. But it wasn't for Fine Gael, it was for Simon Harris.
Yes.
And if you look at that, I don't see why anyone would look at that CV and go, this is a person I can put in a troublesome department, or I can try and improve the career of, and they will do well. They are bad at their job, at anything other than public facing. And he seems to only care about his own public opinion and what the media is saying about him.
Yeah.
And the fact he is still in his position and is getting such an easy ride from the media is grotesque. The man's ineptitude is killing people. Legitimately killing people. He is his existence increases the level of suffering in the country.
This is true. If you're just going to continue an old-fashioned utility test, you would have to say that Simon is not increasing the general good. However, all of this is probably nonsense, and I look forward to the day when, not that long, we are sitting here and having a conversation about the first month of Simon Harris's premiership, because God knows in Irish politics, all things are possible.
Actually, I mean, you know, you put him in a position where he doesn't actually have to implement things. He just needs to let other people do their job. He might actually be okay. I mean, he's failed at every different job we've put him in so far, but conceivably.
Yeah, it's not an experiment that I would look forward to implementing. But
I mean, what's the worst that could happen?
Anyway, for the time being, I think we'll leave beating up on Simon Harris, as much fun as it is, alone. And leave the people back to their lovely Monday. It's still summer, so some people might still be enjoying, well, whatever sunshine there is. And we shall be back on Wednesday, I believe.
Yep, we will be back Wednesday and then Sunday.
Okay, and we'll say for now, bye-bye.
All the best.